Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the next session of the EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. The topic of the month is neuroinfections. And here we are with an interesting topic, I think, about the neuroinfections in times of COVID-19. My name is Tamar Akhledyani. I'm a neurologist from Tbilisi, Georgia. And to discuss about this topic of neuroinfections in times of COVID-19, it's my pleasure to introduce to you Professor Johann Zellner. He is a full professor of neurology and chairs the neurology department in Mistelbach, Austria since 2019. Professor Zellner specializes in neuroinfections, autoimmune and global neurology, and is particularly interested in advancing neurology education. Moreover, he currently co-chairs the EAN Scientific Panel for Infectious Diseases and the NeuroCOVID Task Force of the European Academy of Neurology. Hello, Professor Zellner, and I would like to ask you about the infections that are important worldwide. Can you tell us about this?
Thank you very much for the kind introduction. Infections of the central nervous system are among the most devastating infectious diseases worldwide and often result in medical emergencies that require prompt recognition and treatment. Pathogens may access the CNS by crossing the blood-brain barrier, which normally protects the CNS from microbial invasion, or via transneuronal routes that bypass the blood-brain barrier. Contiguous spread from the upper airways, hematogenous spread from another primary site, and direct inoculation through trauma or surgery are typical pathways leading to bacterial infection. A broad array of infectious agents are capable of invading the nervous system. Involvement of the meninges leads to meningitis. Neuroinvasion of brain parenchyma is termed encephalitis, and infection of the spinal cord is called myelitis. Viral meningitis is by far the most frequent clinical presentation of CNS infections. Enteroviruses and members of the herpes family are the most frequent causes of viral meningitis. Herpes simplex virus and varicella virus can also cause encephalitis. Tick-borne encephalitis virus is an important cause of meningitis and encephalomyelitis in endemic areas. The etiology of bacterial meningitis varies according to age group and immune status. The most frequent infective agents affecting newborns in the first week, Streptococcus agalactiae and Escherichia coli, are replaced by Streptococcus pneumonia and Neisseria meningitidis by the sixth week. Subsequently, Streptococcus pneumonia remains the most common bacterial agent, followed by Neisseria and Listeria monocytogenes. Atypical bacteria can also reach the brain. Mycobacterium tuberculosis causes tuberculosis meningitis and encephalitis. Spirochetes are also responsible for CNS diseases. Treponema pallidum, a sexually transmitted pathogen, causes neurosyphilis in the late stage of infection. Borrelia burgdorferi is transmitted via tick bites and can cause neuroborreliosis, with a wide spectrum of manifestations ranging from neuritis and radiculitis to meningitis and encephalomyelitis.
Thank you. This is a very broad range of very serious neuroinfections, the list you gave us. And can you tell us what happened to these neuroinfections during lockdown periods and in general during the COVID pandemic?
Lockdown is a state or period in which movement within or access to an area is restricted in the interest of public safety or health. The measures encompass stay-at-home orders, curfews, quarantines, closing of schools, set up of home offices, and these measures were implemented worldwide with the intention to reduce the spread of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. By April 2020, about half of the world's population was under some form of lockdown, with more than 3.9 billion people in more than 90 countries or territories having been asked or ordered to stay at home by their governments. Public health recommendations also included the wearing of face masks, social distancing, and universal hygiene precautions such as regular hand washing, and also continued for larger periods in 2022 and 2023. Several independent studies corroborated that lockdowns and public health measures were generally effective at reducing the spread of SARS-CoV-2 and subsequently death by COVID-19. In consequence, pulmonary infections due to other respiratory pathogens also decreased, particularly the numbers of seasonal influenza declined. A few studies focused on changes in the occurrence of CNS infections and came to a similar conclusion. Compared to the pre-pandemic years, the number of patients with bacterial and viral meningitis declined. Moreover, the number of ENT infections went down. The finding that the number of pneumococcal meningitis cases is strikingly reduced suggests that the hygiene measures that were established during the pandemic not only protected from SARS-CoV-2 and direct pulmonary infections, but may have also reduced infections not regarded as primary droplet infection. Indeed, almost half of the adult patients with pneumococcal meningitis suffer from an infection of the mastoid or middle ear or paranasal sinus. Thus, the reduced number of ENT infections with the onset of the pandemic may lead to a lower number of pneumococcal meningitis cases. There are also studies reporting a decline in the number of invasive meningococcal infections with the onset of the pandemic. This is not surprising, as meningococci typically spread via droplets and protection can be established by wearing face masks. The major reasons for reduced viral meningitis cases might be that social distancing, mask wearing, and other hygiene measures were effective. These measures are also likely to have mitigated the transmission of other viruses, such as enteroviruses that are similarly excreted in the respiratory tract and transmitted from person to person by aerosols. Furthermore, enteroviruses are transmitted via a fecal-oral route, which has also been addressed by the hygiene measures such as hand washing. In contrast, neuroinfections by herpes simplex virus and varicella zoster virus remain stable. Of note, these viruses are not transmitted classically via droplets or the fecal-oral route, but result from reactivation of a previous infection. Taken together, the implementation of relatively simple hygiene measures not only reduces the threat of various infections, but may also lead to a decline of other infections that are not considered to be directly contagious, such as pneumococcal meningitis.
I see. And Professor Zellner, now that we are through the pandemic, through these acute situations, what do you think are the lessons learned in terms of dealing with other neuroinfections?
The COVID-19 pandemic changed life as we know it. And it may have changed us individually as well, from our morning routines to our life goals and priorities. From a neuroinfectious disease viewpoint, my lessons are as follows. Wearing of face masks, regular hand washing, and social distancing are effective measures. Vaccination is a powerful tool and should not be missed beyond vaccination against SARS-CoV-2. And eventually, we do have the capacity of resilience.
Do you think that there are additional relevant observations for neuroinfectious diseases during the pandemic?
The COVID-19 pandemic impacted overall population mobility and led to higher than average population mobility within certain regions based on population density. Subsequently, there was increased migration of individuals from high population density areas to areas of lower population density during periods of stringent restriction on mobility, suggesting mobility trended away from epicenters during the pandemic. Also, activities relating to leisure, such as walking, jogging, and weekend trips, increased during the same period. Visits to parks also increased during lockdown periods. This might be the reason for the increased rates of tick-borne infections during the pandemic. Both rates of neuroborreliosis and infection with tick-borne encephalitis virus were observed in times of COVID-19. There were also lower rates of vaccination against tick-borne encephalitis virus, which may also have contributed to the rise of the cases. Eventually, we cannot rule out changes in neurovirulence of Borrelia and tick-borne encephalitis virus during this period.
Thank you, Professor Zellner. And my last question is, I would like to ask your opinion about the how much the neuroinfections and the care about neuroinfections were disrupted during the pandemic. Now that we can look back and evaluate this, what do you think? How much this neuroinfections treatment or management was affected during the pandemic?
I performed a study as the co-chair of the NeuroCOVID-19 Task Force of the EAN entitled The COVID-19 Pandemic and Neurology, a survey on previous and continued restrictions for clinical practice, curricular training, and health economics. We collected 430 responses from 79 countries in spring 2023. The key findings of our study were that, importantly, service for acute neurological infections, similar to the situation as for other time-sensitive conditions such as stroke and epilepsy, were not affected during the pandemic. However, clinical services were cut back in all other neurological subspecialties during the most restrictive COVID-19 lockdown period. The most affected neurological subspecialties were services for patients with dementia, neuromuscular, and movement disorders. The levels of reduction and the pace of recovery were distinct for acute emergencies and in and outpatient care. Recovery was slow for sleep medicine, autonomic nervous system disorders, neurorehabilitation, and dementia care. The ones who are interested in additional findings, including education and economics, are invited to read the full publication, which will be online in the European Journal of Neurology at the time the podcast is being available. The first author of the publication is Dr. Martin Rakuša from Maribor, Slovenia. The case for chronic neuroinfections, however, might be different and similar to other chronic neurological diseases, where services were cut back and did not recover to pre-COVID-19 levels in spring 2023. In this regard, I would like to cover NeuroAIDS. NeuroAIDS is a neurologic condition stemming from a human immunodeficiency virus infection, also termed HIV. The conditions on the neurological side include dementia, neuropathy, acute and chronic brain infections, and disorders of the spine and muscle. Public health measures designed to reduce SARS-CoV-2 transmission led to reduced access to care and prevention services for people living with or at risk of acquiring HIV, particularly during the initial introduction of extensive restrictions. Indeed, several studies reported that testing for HIV declined with the onset of the pandemic, and people living with HIV had difficulty in accessing follow-up care and treatment services. This reduction in access may have contributed to increases in HIV transmission, not outweighed by decreases in transmission occurring as a result of reduced contact rates promoted by the same public health measures. Moreover, we are facing a medication shortage and the risk for running out of antiretroviral treatment is high. There is no cure for HIV, but antiretroviral treatment can control the virus and prevent onward sexual transmission to other people.
Very interesting. Looking forward to this publication. I think that it's very important to have lessons and take lessons from the previous experience, and this pandemic also could give us lots of experience and lessons that we can take into account for the future. So thank you very much for this very interesting discussion, Professor Zellner. I would like to thank the audience for their interest and attention, and see you next time. Goodbye.
Thank you very much for having me.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.